The following program is a presentation for our blind, impaired, and reading impaired listeners from the North Carolina Reading Service. It's the Indie Week, the Independent, and I'm John Federson here to read this issue, which was issued on May the 23rd. Of 2025. Well-packed issue this week, and I'll get right to it now with our first story. And for several weeks now, we've been reading about budgets, city budgets, county budgets, school budgets, and all of that stuff is still going to be happening soon, including final votes on budget proposals. So we'll start in Durham with Justin Laidlaw's column. Durham City Manager Bo Ferguson shared his budget proposal for the 25-6 fiscal year at Monday's City Council meeting. This total budget is $772 million. That's a $54 million, or 8% increase over last year. His budget proposal centered on four priorities: community safety, infrastructure, employee support, and service delivery. To meet the city's growing service needs, Ferguson recommends adding 42 new full-time employees across several departments. Community safety is expected to add 17 new positions, the most of any department, and they include crisis responders, crisis clinicians, street outreach workers, and admin staff. Expansion of the HEART, H-E-A-R-T program was a top priority for city council members and residents. Ryan Smith, director of the community safety department, told the Indy that HEART teams are currently only able to respond to 50 to 55% of eligible calls. Before the first budget public hearing on March 17th, a rally was held outside City Hall where folks advocated for the city to provide enough resources so HEART could operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Ferguson instead proposed focusing first on expanding HEART operations to reach more eligible calls during the day when there is the greatest need, adding that he believes that, quote, HEART will be a 24/7 operation in the not-too-distant future. Infrastructure is another major investment in the manager's budget. The proposal includes funding to keep Go Durham buses fare-free. $17 million from the Durham County Transit Plan for bus service expansion and three new positions to develop a bus rapid transit plan. It also sets aside $500,000 for Vision Zero initiatives to reduce traffic fatalities and $1.2 million from the city's capital improvement plan to continue moving forward on a possible two-way conversion of Roxborough and Mangum Street. That's a big-ticket item for transit advocates. The CIP, that's the Capital Improvement Plan, allots over $500 million to over 70 projects in total. And those are headlined by nearly $159 million investment in Jordan Lake Water Treatment Plant, a much-needed facility to manage Durham's rising water needs as the population continues to grow. Employee pay has been a galvanizing issue dating back to the last mayoral election in 2023. City staff conducted a pay study to adjust salaries based on market competition, which the city implemented in 2024. Ferguson says the new pay plan has already helped reduce turnover and staff vacancies, and his 25-6 proposal includes additional raises to match the city's new minimum livable wage, which jumped from $19.58 to almost $22 per hour. Like the county, property tax collection is the lifeblood of the city's revenue. Due to the updated property valuations that went into effect in January and the growing pool of taxpayers within city limits, the city is expected to bring an additional $47 million in property tax revenue. Now, Ferguson is proposing to cut the property tax rate, just like the county manager, Claudia Hager, but because the revaluation resulted in higher property values, residents will not see a proportionate cut in their property tax bills. After the revaluation process, local municipalities are required to publish a, quote, revenue-neutral tax rate. That's the rate that would be necessary to match the previous fiscal year's budget. Ferguson's proposed property tax rate is 43.7 cents per $100. That's a almost 16-cent decrease from the current rate of 59.62, but it's a 5.48 increase above this revenue-neutral rate. For city residents, the new combined city-county tax rate, 99.13 cents per $100. Should the rates proposed by Ferguson and Hager remain unchanged through the budget development process? Sales and occupancy tax revenue are trending downward, dropping 0.7 and 33% down respectively. Residents have expressed concern with parking and safety, which has hurt local business sales and driven down visitation to downtown, one of Durham's economic hubs. Occupancy tax revenue, on the other hand, is being rerouted, not lost. Last year, local officials worked with state lawmakers to redirect the funds generated from fees on hotel stays and short-term rentals to Discover Durham. That's a local tourism agency, and it's to support the organization's Durham Next initiative. Durham Next will steer the development of big capital improvement projects and other public amenities, hoping to attract residents and visitors to spend locally, driving up sales and occupancy tax revenue. With the new tax rates, a large share of Durham residents can expect a higher tax bill, but that additional revenue for the city is being invested in issues that residents have expressed the most interest in funding through their responses at public hearings and community surveys. The budget may not seem different from recent years, but internally, city staff has had to reconsider how funding is allocated across departments due to an organization-wide restructuring, which the Indy reported in April. Starting July 1, the first day of the new budget cycle, certain departments will have new staff and new responsibilities. City staff had to work through this future reality when building this year's budget proposal. Ferguson says, "Each fall we begin building our budget, and on the surface it may seem like a fairly routine process to folks, but this year, as council knows, was far from routine. Durham County recently completed a full property revaluation, and that created a moment for us to pause and take a fresh look not just at our numbers, but how our city is structured to deliver the services that our community expects." Now that residents have seen that manager's proposal, they will have a number of opportunities to express their enthusiasm or concerns about the budget. The city will host two budget work sessions. One is on May the 28th and 29th at 9 a.m. and a public hearing at their regular city council meeting on June 2nd at 7 p.m. And the city council votes, at least it's scheduled to vote, to adopt the final budget coming right up on June the 16th. And before moving on to other things, we'll slide right over to Raleigh's proposed $1.8 billion budget, which includes raises for city staff, investment in parks, and affordable housing. Raleigh City Manager Marcelle Adams-David presented her $1.78 billion budget proposal for fiscal year 25-6 to the City Council on Tuesday. Highlights include significant pay raises for city staff and investments in affordable housing and Dix Park. The proposal does not include a property tax increase. The rates will remain the same at 35.35 cents per $100. It does include slight fee increases for solid waste, water and sewer, and stormwater services, amounting to an additional $4.33 per year for the median Raleigh household. The proposed budget represents a 25% increase over the current fiscal year budget of $1.4 billion, largely because the city is including bond proceeds in its funding totals for the first time. With the previous methodology that excluded these proceeds, this proposal would represent only a 2% increase over the previous fiscal year. Despite this unusually high top-line figures, this year's proposed budget involves some belt-tightening on Raleigh's part in response to slower growth and, quote, vast economic ambiguity, unquote, as Raleigh's Director of Budget and Management Services, Sadia Sattar, put it to the council on Tuesday. Vast economic ambiguity. Property tax revenue, the city's single biggest funding source, is projected to grow by only 1.95% this year, much less than last year's 16.5% growth. The city's sales tax revenue is expected to decline by 0.5% over last year because of lower consumer confidence brought on by federal funding cuts and changes to tariff and trade policies. To offset the slowdown in revenue growth, Adams David and city staff found $3.2 million in proposed savings across departments and recommended that 6 vacant full-time positions be eliminated. One of the few areas where the city decided to make new investments as opposed to simply preserving the status quo was staff compensation. A recent compensation study revealed City of Raleigh employees earn far less than their peers in comparable cities, about 86% of the market average at the minimum pay raise, and about 93% at the maximum pay ranges. To make worker pay competitive, the budget proposal allocates $35 million to raise full-time employees' pay by 9 to 11%. Part-time employees would get a 5% pay bump. All police, fire, and emergency communication staff would receive the maximum 11% raise. Starting pay for some city jobs, like emergency call takers, would rise by more than 11%. To bring them into the city's updated pay structure. If approved, the salary adjustments will take effect this September. Adams David's budget allocates $11.7 million for Dix Park. That's divided across the Gibson Play Plaza programming, building demolition, and grounds maintenance. There's also $23 million set aside for affordable housing. And half of that total comes from a designated portion of tax revenue for affordable housing, and the other half represents the remainder of the 2020 bond funding. That money will go towards public-private partnerships, gap financing, rehabilitations, and down payment assistance. The proposed budget does not include separation allowance for Raleigh firefighters, a retirement benefit they've been seeking for years. The city has long struggled to retain workers for the high-risk, relatively low-paying job. It does, however, raise firefighters' starting pay from $51,000 to almost $57,000 per year, and allocate $1.3 million for operational and personnel increases within the department. And then finally in this article, other notable line items in the city manager's proposed budget include 31-some million for storm water improvements around the city, 11.6 million for street resurfacing and maintenance, 3.2 million for improvements across Raleigh's parks system, 2.2 million in addition to previously committed funds to expand the Raleigh Convention Center and relocate the Red Hat Amphitheater. There's 1.58 million for multiple greenway improvement projects. There's 1.5 million for improvements to the Martin Marietta Performing Arts Center. $750,000 will go for advanced planning efforts for Nash Square. $600,000 will help pave currently unpaved streets in the city. And $100,000 will replace board docks. That's the platform the city uses to archive city council materials. Now, you can read the budget proposal if you want to, in its entirety. Go to IndyWeek.com online and look for this article, and you can find both the proposal in its entirety and a condensed version, as the links will be listed in this very article that I'm reading you about the Raleigh budget. The city council will adopt a budget by June 30th. You won't believe this. There's yet another article about revenues and particularly home revaluation and tax data. This one about Orange County. In 2021, a coalition of homeowners and advocates noticed that Orange County's tax revaluation had overvalued properties in historically black neighborhoods, leading to a disproportionate tax increase for those residents. The coalition pushed the county to reevaluate properties, which found that the initial assessment had overvalued these properties by more than $10 million. Now, as the county carries out its 2025 revaluation, that same coalition is once again ringing the alarm. Hudson Vaughn, who directs the Community Justice Collaborative, said in a press conference on Monday, "Across the county, the historically black communities are way overvalued compared to other wealthier, historically white neighborhoods and without market justification." And this time, said Vaughn, the disparity is even more widespread. Quote, "This is really beyond a few neighborhoods. Orange County's revaluation is way worse than I expected. I thought, especially after the work folks did with the tax office 4 years ago, that things would look much better this time around." Vaughn shuffled through slides in a depressing The Price is Right game, showing dozens of examples of older and smaller houses that are receiving higher adjustments than their newer and larger counterparts. The century-old, that's a 1,700-square-foot, three-bed, two-bath family home of the late Marianne Cheek Jackson, for instance, was assessed to have a tax value higher than that of a swanky 3,700-square-foot, six-bed, six-and-a-half-bath, 2024 construction in the same neighborhood. One-third-acre property with an affordable tiny home was assigned a higher land value than a 0.8% parcel with a house that is currently listed for $6.6 million. It doesn't quite add up. Vaughn says there's inconsistent and inequitable land valuation in Orange County's new valuation. There's an overvaluation of low-price housing and an undervaluation of high-priced. And there's a double standard. Similar market increases in white versus black neighborhoods lead to much higher increased average values in historically black neighborhoods. He added that part of the problem is that neighborhoods with older houses are more difficult to assess, saying they take more decision-making by the assessment office because they're very heterogeneous. Properties are different sizes, different ages, so they have to do a lot more to adjust. It's not simply like a condominium or townhouse development. The Orange County Property Tax Justice Coalition has a plan. Earlier in the spring, they recruited volunteers to help with the process of fighting for neighborhood-wide revaluations through the proper channels of informal and formal appeals with the tax office. George Barrett, executive director of the Marion Cheek Jackson Center, added that the county should increase funding for anti-displacement initiatives, specifically that long-time homeowners assistance LHA program. In an email to Indy, Orange County Community Relations Director Will Glenn said the county, quote, follows a rigorous data-driven valuation process rooted in state law and appraisal best practices. The county is already reviewing more than 3,500 appeals and continues to welcome more, he said. Orange County recognizes and respects the concerns raised by community members about property tax valuations, especially in historically underserved neighborhoods. The county's priority is ensuring that every property owner feels heard and is treated fairly, said Glenn. He also noted that county leadership and representatives of the tax office met with coalition members last month and urged them to submit appeals, saying, during that meeting, the tax administrator encouraged appeals for individual properties and stated that if there were entire neighborhoods that have issues, provide information on those neighborhoods and a way to identify them, and the county would take it to the Board of Equalization and Review to ask if neighborhood-wide adjustments should be made similar to 2021. But, Barrett said at the press conference, the appeals process puts a lot of continued burden on all the folks in these communities to submit these appeals when we know there are tools the office and the county can use to make these neighborhood adjustments and take this on from a systemic level. All right, next, some spot news that's not related to a specific thing like tax assessment and budgets. A judge has ordered the release of body camera footage from a crash that killed Tyrone Mason. A Wake County judge on Friday morning, this was filed, by the way, on May the 16th, ordered the North Carolina State Highway Patrol, SHP, to release body cam footage of a state trooper's interaction with Tyrone Mason, a Raleigh man who died in a crash on Capitol Boulevard last October. The order comes after unsealed search warrants from the State Bureau of Investigation, SBI, detailed suspicious actions of the particular state trooper, Garrett Macario, and his supervisor, Sergeant Matthew Morrison, following the crash. Raleigh police told news outlets that Mason, 31, was driving in the early hours of October 7 when he crashed into a concrete barrier. Police said Mason was speeding and lost control of his car. The search warrants describe Macario's body camera footage of the events, which apparently show him attempting to pull Mason over and then disengaging. The warrants say Mason crashed after Macario disengaged. Macario then parked nearby, called our police department, Raleigh Fire, and an EMS, then called his supervisor, Morrison. According to these warrants, Morrison asked Macario if he had called in a vehicle chase over the radio, and Macario said he had not. The warrant state Morrison told Macario, quote, the traffic accident was RPD's problem and not to tell responding Raleigh Police Department officers that he tried to stop Mason before the traffic accident. The warrants go on to say Macario told an RPD officer who responded to the scene he had not attempted to pull Mason over. In January, Wake District Attorney Lauren Freeman viewed Macario's body camera footage of the crash and announced she was dismissing roughly 180 pending cases involving Macario and Morrison. The dismissals led to speculation that the crash happened as a result of a chase. Freeman and the SBI are currently investigating the crash. And Macario and Morrison are currently on administrative leave pending criminal and internal investigations into their conduct. So Judge Thomas Curran said on Friday, before ordering this release of the footage, as soon as possible, the release of these videos is necessary. It advances a compelling public interest, namely confidence in law enforcement. He added the public has a compelling right to know why Freeman dismissed so many cases involving the two officers. And the order comes after a coalition of news outlets, including Indy, petitioned State Highway Patrol to release the body cam footage, and the Raleigh Police Department subsequently made its own motion to the same effect. During Friday's hearing, Joseph Vellon, a special deputy attorney general, argued on behalf of the Highway Patrol, Macario's body cam footage should not be released publicly until after the internal and criminal investigations are complete. Curran said the pending investigations do not outweigh the public interest in releasing the footage, saying that especially in this day and age, it is of the utmost importance to instill confidence in the eyes and minds of the public in those public servants who do their job, and for those who do not, be held to account. Macario and Morrison were not present for the virtual hearing. Freeman was present and told Curran she has no objection to the footage being released. She added that her office and the SBI will make an announcement about their investigation into Macario and Morrison's conduct in the coming weeks. So Curran ordered the SHP to release the body cam footage with graphic images blurred as soon as possible, but no later than 4 days after the entry of his order. So that ends the article. By my estimate, that footage will have been released by this date. Well, next, more depressing news from St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Bankruptcy filing has halted a six-figure legal dispute between St. Augustine's University Board of Chair and former trustee. A two-year legal dispute between the board chair, Brian Boulware, and former trustee, George Brooks, reached an anticlimactic detent last week when Boulware's three companies declared bankruptcy, triggering an indefinite pause in the proceedings. Well, the two men, both of Atlanta, have been entangled in litigation since 2022 when Boulware defaulted on a six-figure business loan from Brooks. More recently, a judge found that Boulware used some of that loan, which he still hasn't repaid, for personal expenses, including the purchase of a Range Rover and payments to an St. Augustine's employee named Wanda Wagner. According to legal filings, Boulware, an entrepreneur, and Brooks, a United Parcel Service executive, got into business together in 2021 while they were both serving as trustees of St. Aug's. Brooks invested $600,000 across Boulware's three Georgia cigar businesses, Studio Cigars, Wise Ash Cigars 2, and BB Cigars Distributors. Soon after, Boulware began defaulting on interest payments and Brooks sued him and his companies to recoup the loan. Brooks also resigned from St. Aug's board in 2024. And after years of legal back and forth, a Georgia court ruled in Brooks's favor in January, ordering Boulware to pay back the original loan with interest. The judge found that Boulware had been abusing his business bank accounts, quote, as a mere extension of his personal affairs, unquote, spending over $100,000 on hotels, meals, entertainment, the Range Rover, and those payments to Wagner. Boulware disputed the ruling and asked for a new trial, arguing that he had been unable to properly defend himself because his former lawyer had withdrawn from the case and he had contracted bronchitis ahead of the trial, so he could not appear in court. The judge agreed to give Boulware another chance and scheduled a final hearing for last Friday, May the 16th. But on Thursday, May the 15th, Boulware's three cigar companies all declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy. At the hearing the next morning, the judge placed the case into a stay status, essentially pausing Brooks's lawsuit indefinitely on account of Boulware's company's funds being tied up in bankruptcy proceedings. Well, Boulware, Brooks, and their lawyers did not respond to Indy's request for comment. Also on May 15th, just before the hearing, Brooks' lawyer, Vernon Strickland, submitted a brief to the court arguing that Brooks should be able to, quote, pierce the corporate veil, unquote, and reclaim his money directly from Boulware rather than from his company. Strickland argues in that brief that since Boulware, quote, disregarded the separateness of the corporate entity from himself, he should be held personally liable for the debt. Outside of court, Boulware is fending off harsh criticism of his leadership at St. Augustine's. As the school teeters on the brink of a loss of accreditation, a long list of alumni, former employees, and former trustees have laid the blame for its current financial and reputational woes at his feet, accusing him of mismanagement and overreach during his time as board chair. Boulware, for his part, maintains that St. Augustine's challenges date back to previous negligent administrations, and he is the right person to navigate the school through its existential challenges. Well, a final decision, at least on the university's accreditation, is due later this summer. I believe I reported there was another stay, more or less, in executing this last decision, which itself is one of a few appeals of it when they lost their accreditation previously. Next, a return to politics and government. This written in May 15th, Democrats need to show who we are, Durham's new Democratic Party chair. After that election in 24, Democrats were forced to do some soul-searching. One of the primary takeaways is that party leadership is, quite frankly, too damn old, writes Justin Laidlaw. A new class of political leaders are gathering their forces and preparing to upend the gerontocracy. In North Carolina, 27-year-old Anderson Clayton, chair of the statewide Democratic Party, has been hard at work cultivating enough resources to prop up a Democratic candidate in every open seat in the state. Nationally, David Hogg, the 25-year-old vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, recently made waves within the party by stating his intentions to support primary candidates in a number of upcoming elections. Durham may soon have its own youth movement. Emerson Kirby, a Durham native, got involved in local politics at a young age, volunteering on campaigns with different nonprofits. Last year, she graduated from Duke University with a bachelor's degree in public policy. During her junior year at Duke, Kirby was elected third vice chair of the Durham Democrats, where she served for 2 years until April, when she rose to the top chair position. Even though Kirby is still a young operative, she comes to the position with experience and a sense of personal responsibility to represent other young residents whose voices aren't being heard. Her responses are polished, and her delivery fits a job that requires practiced communication and the ability to persuade voters that your agenda will give them the best outcomes. We spoke with Kirby on the heels of her new appointment as chair of the Durham County Democratic Party to find out what her plans are to capture disaffected voters, how to bring new energy to the party at the local and state level, and why Democrats need to sharpen their message and move away from being just the party of anti-Trump. And the remainder of this article is a Q&A format. And here we go. How did you get involved with the local Democratic Party? I was born and raised in Durham and really care about the community here. I started getting involved in local politics when I was in high school. I was a youth leader for Kids Voting Durham and a participant in the Durham Participatory Budgeting Initiative. And I have some family members who have run for office in other parts of the state. So I became very interested in how I could participate more deeply in my own Durham community. I found out there was the upcoming county convention in early 23 and saw an opening for the third vice chair position. I've been doing social media communications and website stuff for a small business here in Durham for quite a while, and some other social media stuff on the side. The third vice chair role is social media and communication, so I thought that would be a perfect way for me to deepen my involvement in the community and Durham politics. What other things are the Durham Democrats doing locally for the party besides voter registration? So we do what we call precinct organizing. Precincts are kind of the basis of the party. We have 59 here in Durham, and when you organize a precinct, which is basically a neighborhood, you're able to have a precinct chair, vice chair, and secretary that's represented in the Durham Democrats. Those chairs go out in their neighborhood, build community, get people involved. That's one of the main ways we build community here in Durham. We hold community events, hold candidate forums when municipal elections come up, and provide resources to our precincts to help them build up community in their neighborhoods. How much of your organizing is focused on local government compared to state and federal? We're very focused on our county in particular and how we can best serve the needs of our county and the wants of the people in Durham. But because some of the more tumultuous things that are going on at the state level, we've been getting more involved, canvassing, advocating, especially for Justice Allison Riggs and her state on the state Supreme Court, her seat, because that's a statewide issue, and every county needs to be involved in making sure she wins that election so there's not a precedent set for other elections to fall through the cracks and be overturned. Durham is such a homogeneous voting block for state and federal elections, and most of our local election officials are Democrats, so how much are the Durham Democrats involved in local races, given the amount of homogeneity? Yeah, that's a great question. So we mostly do get-out-the-vote initiatives. When it comes to municipal elections, we don't usually make endorsements because we are such a blue stronghold and they're all typically Democratic candidates. But because people are less engaged in some of the municipal elections, we push really hard to do voter registration and get people excited to go vote for the people that are actually going to be making community decisions. Democrats are upset about how the party handled the transition from Biden to Harris and the outcome of the election. And Republicans are mad about a lot of the choices that folks in power have made about cutting certain programs and tariffs, etc. So I'm wondering how you all are thinking about trying to tap into that frustration and grab those folks who are becoming more apathetic and re-engage voters who may be turned off as we move into the 26 midterms. Yeah, I agree with you. There's kind of two sides of the spectrum. There's people who are energized and excited to do things, and there are people who feel the opposite. They're tired of politics and tired of the Democrats and the Republicans and hearing about them. On a national level and on a local level, Democrats need to show who we are. We need to show our value to people. what we believe in and how we can support our communities and make sure that people know we aren't just asking for money and votes. We're not just knocking on doors every 4 years, and we're not just the party of anti-Trump. We are a party that cares about people, that has deep, deep values, and wants to listen to people year-round. Because how can we ask people to serve us if we don't serve them? So I think on a local level, that shows up as having community events all across the county, partnering with different local organizations so we can meet people where they are, and having community service events like book drives and food drives, providing that value and service to people, which in turn lets people know our beliefs and what we care about. You just recently graduated from Duke and are bringing young energy to the Durham Dems. You've got Wesley Knott in Wake County, who's in his last 20s and just took over the chair position for the party there. Anderson Clayton, head of the state Democratic Party, is 27. That's a lot of young leadership grabbing holds of the reins within the Democratic apparatus here in the state. What do you think it says about where the Democrat Party is and where it needs to go, or where it's trying to go, given that so many young people are saying, hey, maybe it's our turn now to try to steer the ship? Yeah, that's a great question. I think nationally we're seeing some frustration with the leadership of Democrats and how a lot of those leaders are a little bit older than the median age in the United States. And young people don't necessarily feel they're being represented by these leaders, especially some of the leaders who are not taking a harsh stance against some of the unconstitutional actions that we're seeing on a national and state level. I'm really excited to prove that young people do have the ability to lead and serve. I feel very honored to serve in this role. Here in Durham, specifically, we're seeing a huge influx of younger people moving into the city and county. And so I feel like I, to an extent, represent a large chunk of who Durham is continuing to grow into. So it's my goal to partner with the people that have been in politics for a long time, not cancel them out of the conversation, but just be a voice in the larger room to be a part of this rich history of Democratic leadership in Durham. I know you spent some time volunteering with different political groups. You studied public policy at Duke, but frankly, you don't have a ton of experience in the space compared to some of your older peers. So what new ideas are you trying to bring to the position that you think will be really valuable to the Dems, both here in Durham and regionally? There's kind of a lack of coherent message that's not just anti-Trump, and it's important to show people in the county, state, and across the country who we are, what we believe in, and how we can support our communities. So I feel my experience in communications and messaging helps me understand how to connect with people, especially online, which is becoming one of the biggest ways that people get their information and connect with others. And although I'm young, I've been on the leadership team of Durham Democrats for the past couple of years, so I feel I have a pretty solid understanding of where we can go, what we could do better, what our strengths are and our weaknesses, and how we can improve to make sure we're getting out the vote for the municipal elections. You mentioned that the part of the challenge is creating messaging that's not just anti-Trump. What is the Democratic Party doing well, and how do you illuminate those successes for folks who maybe aren't as plugged in, particularly for folks who maybe aren't online and aren't following the news as much so they're aware when they go to the ballot box next time around? We've been having a lot of local protests all across the state and nationally as well, like the hands-off protest and No Kings protest. That's a great way to get out into the streets and inform people about what's going on, even if they may not be online. So I think that even though we need to do more talking about what we believe in as Democrats, we are doing a much better job than we were before of informing people about how exactly Trump harms the economy and doing corrupt things and going directly against the Supreme Court and deporting people without due process, people are starting to realize and be informed of these things and get even more involved. We're seeing a growth, not necessarily just the Democratic Party, but of people who don't want to see this in the leadership of our country. Final question, what are your own political ambitions? I know this chair position is very fresh, but do you see yourself running for office in the future? I'm not sure yet. I'm really focused on the now, but I don't have super high political goals that I'm thinking about at the moment. I'm thinking less about political career and more about how I can serve the people of Durham. At some point, I may go to law school, but I'm not at all thinking about running for office right now. I'm thinking about what I can best do in this role to make the biggest difference in Durham. That's what a savvy politician would say. Good answer. Well, I'll continue filling the time with a couple of small articles, and this one, the Weekly Lunch Money this week, talks about Yagsi 10, an African restaurant in Apex. And this is, the column is about where to get food, very good, best meal for low dollars. And Lena Geller writes, when I walk into Yagsi 10, an African restaurant that shares a building with an urgent care center, the dining room is empty, so I take a few minutes to look around. There's a lot to take in. Tables and chairs are painted with flags from African countries, a visual representation of the restaurant's pan-African approach, rather than focusing on just one cuisine. One corner of the restaurant has pillows on the ground and a sign inviting diners to remove their shoes and eat with your natural silverware hands. Painted on the wall behind those pillows is a thatched roof hut with wooden doors. Instruments hang from the ceiling, a gourd wrapped in a woven beaded net, a thumb piano. Two TVs are on, one playing a silent slideshow of menu dishes on the menu, the other airing the World Table Tennis Champion. Suddenly, someone tall and smiling emerges from the kitchen wearing a name tag that says owner/Papa Fall, available. He hands me a menu and instructs me to sit down and look it over. Before heading back to the kitchen, he points to a wooden xylophone-like instrument on the counter. If I'm in the back and I don't hear you, just do this, he says, using mallets to drum the instrument three times. I sit down at the Tanzania table and study the menu. It is extensive. Beyond the entrees, platters, and sandwiches, there are beverages, ginger, turmeric lemonade, baobab cocktails, soups, cow feet with potatoes, spicy fish and carrots, appetizers, turkey, tuna, or vegan patties, extremely spicy piri piri wings, sides of jollof rice and pounded yam, and desserts, apple beignets, curdled milk with millet couscous, with countries of origin listed next to each dish. I count at least 24 African nations. Most of the platters, of which there are more than 30, with chicken, seafood, goat, lamb, oxtail, vegetarian, and vegan options, run between $13 and $20, but there are a few within my price range. I'm eyeing the Senegalese Yassa Ganar platter, that's jerk chicken, in citrus onion sauce for $11, or, to coordinate with my table, the Serengeti sandwich, a spinach wrap with grilled lamb for $9, when I notice a whiteboard in the front of the restaurant. Lunch special with Moroccan mint tea, $10.99. Three options are listed, Dorowat, fish curry over rice, and Nambe. I walk up to read the board more closely, and Papa Fall returns when I mention I'm torn between the specials. He asks about dietary restriction. The nambe, black-eyed peas and yucca in a chapati wrap, is vegan. No restrictions, I tell him. Do you do okay with spicy? I nod. He recommends Dorowat and says it's one of Ethiopia's most famous dishes. That's chicken served with injera, that's that crepe-like flatbread that in fact is a tablecloth in some restaurant settings. Gomen, Ethiopian collard greens, and kilkil, green beans. My bill comes for this special comes to $12.23 with tax. The tip options only allow whole dollar amounts and without cash. For an exact change, I add $3, bringing my total to $15.23, slightly over budget, but only because of tip interface limitations. Papa Fall asks whether I want my Moroccan mint tea sweet or unsweet. Sweet, I tell him. He pours it from a large container behind the counter and hands it over, and it is both refreshing and comforting, marrying the soothing quality of peppermint tea when you're sick with the cheerful sweetness of iced tea at a summer gathering. About 5 minutes later, Papa Fall emerges with my food on a wooden platter shaped like the African continent, accompanied by a water pitcher. There's a side table with utensils, but I do opt to eat with my hands. The Doro Wat consists of a bone-in chicken thigh and drumstick, bright red from berberi sauce, and swimming in a rich complex, berber spice, swimming in a rich complex sauce. Four rolls of injera are tucked around the edges of the platter. The chicken pulls apart easily, and the meat is infused with layers of heat that build without overwhelming. The collard greens are earthy and aromatic, flecked with Chilean seeds. My favorite, the kilkil, cooling and gingery, a perfect counterpoint to the spiced chicken. Pardon me? Oh, sorry for that. I have a Bugs Bunny cartoon as my ringtone, and I left it on. All right, I could just continue about her talking about the kilkil, a perfect counterpoint to the spiced chicken. I use pieces of the spongy injera to scoop everything up. As I eat, Papa Fall stops by to check on me, and we chat. He's from Senegal. After moving to the U.S., spent 25 years working at TGI Fridays. When he would get off work, he found himself frustrated by the options around him, Jersey Mike's, Mexican places, nowhere serving the kind of African food he was craving. Eventually, he decided to solve the problem himself, and he started Yagsi 10 in 2012 as a food truck and expanded into catering and wholesale. Through years of research, he developed a menu representing cuisines from across the African continent. When African diners walk in, sometimes driving hours or more to get there, they look at the flags and see their country. They feel right at home, he says. Before I leave, he explains the restaurant's name, pointing to a circular artwork on the wall depicting women drawing water from a well. When he was young, living in a Senegalese village, he would see women drawing water like this, and they would be singing the words Yagsi 10, he says. It means, basically, if you're patient and you persevere, you shall get more water out of the well of the world, Papa Fall says. That stuck with me. So again, that column is called Lunch Money, and I guess the goal is to get a decent meal for $12 plus tax and tip. All right, let's see what I have time for in 4 minutes. And that article, after a journey around the moon, a tree takes root in Durham. On Tuesday, March 18th, Ryan Sailstott, Recreation and Operations Supervisor for Durham Parks and Rec, received an unexpected text message. A UPS shipment had arrived. Following standard protocol, he drove to the main Parks and Rec office, where he was met by a delivery driver, holding a large box, roughly 6 inches wide and about 60 inches tall. Do you know what you're holding? Sailstott asked. Driver shook his head, and Sailstott opened the box right then and there in the parking lot. You had a tree on your truck that went around the moon. From this seed that went all the way around the moon, you had a part in bringing it to its final place. The shocked delivery driver pulled out his phone to take photos, eager to share the moment with his wife. The day before, on Monday, March 17th, Sailstott was also stunned when he received an email from NASA announcing the moon tree was on its way. He said, I kind of forgot about it. The moon tree is part of the Artemis program, a nationwide initiative launched by NASA and the U.S. Forest Service. In collaboration, the two agencies launched 1,200 seeds of loblolly pine, Douglas fir, giant sequoia, American sycamore, and sweet gum trees into lunar orbit aboard the Orion spacecraft. The seeds traveled 1.4 million miles, leaving Earth in 2022 and returning on December 11th. The mission is an ode to a moment from over 50 years ago when astronaut Stuart Roosa carried tree seeds around the moon on Apollo 14. One of those original moon trees stands in Pisgah, North Carolina. That tree, which Sehlstedt visited years earlier, inspired him to apply for a moon tree on behalf of Durham Parks and Rec in 2023 after learning about the tree program. It was one of those things. I was like, we might as well, he said. The application process, fairly standard with an emphasis on community impact and the ability to care for the tree. He specified that the tree would reside near the Environmental Education Pavilion at West Point on the Eno, where it could serve as a resource for scientific and environmental education and community engagement. And he says it kind of made sense we would have a moon tree there so we could program around it. There would be staff ready to interpret, so it wouldn't just sit in a park and just sort of be there. It would be something, a feature of these programs. Once he learned the tree was a loblolly pine, Sehlstedt and his colleague Tom Dawson explored the area to find the most suitable spot where it can grow up to 115 feet tall. They chose a location at the highest point along the trail, an ecologically ideal setting that's protected by other trees yet, sunlit and easily accessible to visitors. Together, the two dug a hole, planted the sapling, gave it some water, made sure it was level. And that's the kind of cool thing about a moon tree, Sehlstedt said. It was more than just planting a tree. It was special, but it was also just planting a tree. Today, the sapling is secured by a temporary wooden fence, shielding it from outside threats like humans or animals. Eventually, once a tree settles, that fence will come down. Children will gather around it on field trips, and adults will enjoy it from the nearby park benches that Parks and Rec plans to install. All right, and I must curtail my presentation of Indie Week this week. And there comes my house band to tell me to close it up. John Federson for The Independent, reading this current issue, and I'll be back next Thursday. This issue, by the way, goes into, we broadcast on Friday. It's a podcast. And all of this and other previous issues are available at ncreadingservice.org. If you go to that website, you'll find immense compendiums of various programs from about 20 periodicals and books. And they're all available free of charge. Just get over to indieweek.com for a print version of what you just heard, and ncreadingservice.com, which says, so long for now. Thank you.